Good evening and welcome to the local news. Today is Monday, July 14th. I'm Jordan Pangelinan, reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, KMUD continues to cover the Orleans and Marble Complex fires. Firefighters are using different tactics to prevent growth. And Eureka planners overturn committee's denial of housing project. Stay tuned for those stories and more coming right up. On Thursday, July 10th, according to the press release from the Humboldt County Sheriff's Office, announced a missing person who had been swept downstream after falling into the river. 45-year-old Sean Nomura was last seen near Blue Creek, wearing gray shorts, red shoes, and no shirt. On July 13th, 2025, the Humboldt County Sheriff's Office, the Special Services Division, recovered the body of a deceased male in the Klamath River. Following notification of next kin, the deceased was identified as Nomura, who had fallen into the river 2 days prior. The two-day-long search involved multiple agencies, including the Humboldt County Search and Rescue, the Yurok Tribal Police, Hoopa Tribal Police, California Highway Patrol, CAL FIRE, and more. Air and boat units were also used in the search along the fast-moving river. A reminder from the Humboldt County Sheriff's Office per press release, as our community grieves this tragic loss, we also want to gently remind everyone to use caution around our local rivers. Even in summer, water conditions can be swift, cold, and unpredictable. Please wear a life jacket, stay aware of changing currents, and look out for one another near the water. KMUD staff and the Humboldt County Sheriff's Office extends its heartfelt condolences to the family and friends of Mr. Nomura during this difficult time. KMUD News brings an update on the ongoing homicide investigation stemming from the incident that occurred near the Glendale area on July 8, 2025. Lieutenant Jesse Taylor of the Humboldt County Sheriff's Office shares key developments and outlines the sequence of events that have led to the current stage of the investigation.
On July 8th, our deputies responded to a call of a gunshot wound victim in the 900 block of Glendale Drive. Deputies located the victim, who was later identified as Joshua Lee McCollister. He's a 37-year-old male out of Fort Bragg. He was in a dispute with another couple of subjects and sustained a gunshot wound. Unfortunately and tragically, he passed away as a result of his injuries.
Following an extensive investigation, MCD detectives identified Danielle Roberta Durand, 41, as a suspect in a homicide that occurred on Glendale Road, and a Rummy warrant was issued for her arrest. As SWAT prepared to enter the residence, Durand left in a vehicle and was apprehended during a traffic stop on Highway 101 near the Bayside Cutoff.
Our Major Crimes Division detectives were called out to the scene, and through their investigation, they were able to locate or identify two suspects in the case. Those subjects were identified as Danielle Roberta Duran, and then also, I don't know how to say his first name, I'll spell it D-E-U-N-N Willis. Both from Arcata as the suspects in this case. Based on some of the information that we had received, our SWAT team was activated to serve a search warrant in Arcata. On July 11th, we did that, served a search warrant at a residence in the 100 block of H Street in Arcata. And prior to arriving on scene, Ms. Durand had left the residence in a vehicle. She was later stopped on a traffic stop on Highway 101. And then as we rolled back to the residence in Arcata, the SWAT team entered the residence and located the male suspect and later booked him as well as Ms. Durand on charges for murder, conspiracy, and robbery.
The victim in this case has been identified as Joshua Lee McCollister, 37, of Fort Bragg, California. The Humboldt County Sheriff's Office continues to investigate this case and encourages anyone with information to contact the Major Crimes Division. Anyone with information about this case can call the Humboldt County Sheriff's Office at 707-445-7251 or the Sheriff's Office Crime Tip Line at 707-268-2539. KMUD News will continue to report as details are released. Operations Section Chief on California Team 9, Jeff Hansen, gives an update on the Marble Complex from the Klamath National Forest Facebook news release on today's overview of activity of both fires, status, and plans for today and going forward.
My name is Jeff Hansen. I'm Operations Section Chief on California Team 9. We're here on the Marble Complex. Today is July the 14th, 2025. Hey, so I'll start like I always do on the Jacket Fire down here. It's near Sawyer's Bar and Yellow Jacket Ridge. We were able to contain that fire a handful of days ago. We've been checking it daily. There's no smoke, no heat on the fire. So things are looking really good on the Jacket. Up on the summit, same thing. Things are looking really good. Up on the north end up here, you know, we've had hand line on that for 3 or 4 days now. The crews have been in mopping up, really searching and destroying smokes out there that have any threat to the containment line. So we're really feeling good on this north end. Same on the east end here on the divide of the Pacific Crest Trail. You have the Shackleford drainage off to the northeast, and then the Woolly Creek drainage is where the fire is. And you got the Pacific Crest Trail that we've been able to hold fire on or near with the rock outcroppings that are also in association with the Pacific Crest Trail. Coming down around here, we've tied into natural barriers, which are rock outcroppings around the Maneaton Lake. And I'll even go further and say it's not just rock outcroppings, it's the crest of the Marble Mountains here. So no threat off to the south here with all the granite that's out there. Crews down in here, we're able to cut line. We went and tied into that rock escarpment that I was talking about, and we've been able to do some tactical firing to bring fire to our lines. Things are looking really good out there, calming down quickly, and we still have crews engaged. They're spiked out there, and they're out there 24 hours a day. Starting today, we're going to start pulling a few crews off the line. That's how good we're feeling about the fire. We can start pulling people off. We're not replacing them with other crews. Wind down this week. We plan on having everyone off the line by Thursday, with the exception of one crew that's going to stay out for a few more days to keep an eye on things and wrap it up for us. Through this heat wave that we're having, we're definitely keeping an eye on all these fires and still engaged and still going at it. So we hope you all have a good day. Thanks.
The extreme heat warning for the Marble Complex area has been extended through Tuesday, with another chance of thunderstorms returning on Monday. While overall fire behavior has significantly decreased, crews remain alert for any shifts in weather that could influence conditions on the fire. High temperatures, low humidity, and the possibility of gust winds from storms will keep firefighters watchful as operations continue. An area closure order is currently in effect due to the Summit Fire. Residents and visitors are asked to avoid these areas and remain vigilant of changing fire conditions. A combination of evacuation warnings and orders are in place for both Summit and Jacket Fire. Visit the Office of Emergency Services Disaster Management for the Siskiyou County of California. You can also find more information on your evacuation warning or orders on protectgenesis.com. That is protect.genasys.com. To stay updated and informed, you can also sign up for watchduty.org or by typing in Humboldt Alert Sign Up in your internet browser. KMUD will continue to update as we get more information. Paul Mesnerich, the Six Rivers National Forest Public Information Officer for the Orleans Complex Fire, gives an overview on today's operations and information regarding evacuation zones.
My name is Paul Mesnerich. I'm a Public Information Officer on the Orleans Complex, which is two wildfires burning up in Northern California, the Red Fire and the Butler Fire. So the Red Fire is about 116 acres and 50% contained. The fire itself is pretty contained within a drainage in the Siskiyou Wilderness area, and so that one is pretty manageable. And then about 25, 30 miles to its southeast, that's the Butler Fire. So the Butler Fire is outside of the city of Orleans, and it's been kind of gradually moving eastward toward the Salmon River Road and Salmon River. And so the communities being impacted by this fire right now are the communities of Butler Flat and Forks of Salmon. So evacuations are actually handled by the county law enforcement. And so Siskiyou County has actually issued evacuation orders for those locations. Whether people follow those orders or not is to their discretion, but those areas are under an evacuation order by the county. There's about 50 residences that comprise those two locations. So from the fire management side, our firefighters have been working for the last few days on, you know, protecting the structures within those areas and then doing some defensive firing is what we call that. So, you know, during the nighttime when conditions are favorable, we might light some fires from the edge of the communities up the slope to kind of reduce the available fuels or vegetation for those fires. And then similarly, we've been using unmanned aerial systems. People commonly refer to them as drones, where we'll drop these devices from the drones that will catch fire when they hit the ground, and for the similar reason. You know, we're trying to burn up some of that available fuel and vegetation under favorable conditions. So that way, when that wildfire finally hits that area, there's just less available for it to feed on, and it really dampens its intensity. So those tactics have been pretty successful. Last night, the fire finally did reach the outskirts of those communities, and so far, structures have been protected, so our efforts have been doing really well in that regard.
Moving forward today, Mesnerich explains more fire tactics firefighters are using to help prevent growth in the area.
So today is going to be an important day on the fire. We've been using aircraft, helicopters, dropping water buckets, and we actually have firefighters in boats along the Salmon River, just because east of the Salmon River, there's a area of land that hasn't seen wildfire in a while. So it has, again, pretty thick, dense vegetation that if fire were to cross the river into that area, it would be problematic. And so today we've been having high temperatures, triple-digit temperatures for the last several days, but it has not been that windy. So the fire hasn't moved that much or that quickly. It's still relatively calm wind-wise, except there is an uptick. And so now that the fire is closer to the road and closer to the river, and the wind is picking up a bit, they're forecasting that we might have occasional gusts up to 25 miles an hour. There's a potential that sparks can go from this fire west of the river and blow over into that land east of the river. And so that's why we have firefighters in boats. So if something does blow over and take root, we can hopefully get to it in time and contain it before it takes off, because that area east of the river would be pretty susceptible to another fire. If it, we use the term spotting when a fire jumps from its current perimeter over the perimeter boundary into another area. So there's that potential for spotting today that we're really trying to guard against.
The road between Butler Flat and Nordheimer Campground remains closed as rocks and burning debris continue to fall in the roadway. Nordheimer and Oak Bottom Campgrounds are also closed. Extreme heat continues today with highs forecast at 105 degrees. Winds will slightly pick up out of the northwest with occasional gusts up to 25 miles an hour. Persistently high temperatures will keep fuels dry and increase potential fire dangers. Individuals seeking relief from the heat by recreating in streams or rivers or in the forest need to be mindful of their vehicle's condition or where they park. Roadside sparks or dried vegetation against the heated undercarriage of a vehicle could quickly result in a wildfire. The Six Rivers and Klamath National Forest are not currently in fire restrictions. However, campfires should never be left unattended and should be dead out and cool to the touch before leaving. Remember, drown, stir, feel, and repeat. Report suspected wildfires by calling 911. To stay updated, you can visit watchduty.org or by typing in Humble Alert Signup in your internet browser. For information on zones, visit protect.genesis.com. That's protect.genasys.com. KMUD News will continue to update as we get new information. The Eureka Design Review Committee's rejection of a multifamily housing project is at odds with the city's development standards and has been overturned by the Planning Commission. Daniel Mintz reports.
Eureka's support of new housing has been affirmed with the City Planning Commission's approval of a multifamily housing project whose neighbors object to it. At its July 9th meeting, the commission reversed a denial of the project, by the city's Design Review Committee. The committee had denied the project based on concerns over neighborhood compatibility. Centrally located at 1822 I Street near the Del Norte Street intersection, the project consists of 7 two-bedroom units in a two-story building. Assistant planner Henry Baker said the project's density, building height, and parking are all within the city's development standards for the neighborhood. But neighborhood residents told the commission they're concerned about the project's scale and its impacts on traffic and parking. Brad Kurse, a nearby resident, said the project's size is out of proportion with its surroundings.
Most of the buildings around here that are multi-family units, apartments and stuff like that, are duplexes and fourplexes. So this sevenplex is a step up in its size. I was thinking that an identical lot probably is the Squire project down at 10th and H. That's just such an eyesore. That would fit in perfectly with that. It's the same size. All those buildings down there are larger. Why isn't that being used instead of our area, which is already filled with traffic, filled with kids, and most of the buildings are just, like I said, the largest buildings that we have are duplexes and fourplexes. I understand the state has a mandate for increasing housing. I understand, but can't that be also taken care of by a duplex or a fourplex? A sevenplex with the bleed out of the cars is a nightmare.
Several other neighbors raised similar concerns with those living adjacent to the project site, saying they'll be particularly affected by the project's size. But Colin Fisk of the Coalition for Responsible Transportation Priorities said infill development in areas that are developed and close to the downtown area is an alternative to expansion into forests, fields, and wetlands.
Our belief, as well as I think is consistent with the policies of the city and the state, is that we should be putting the new housing in those infill locations. This is a pretty good location. It's less than a mile from downtown. It has access to the existing public transit system in the city and the growing bike network in the city. It provides those transportation options. And really, as far as the scale of it, the fact is that it's consistent with the zoning code. We really don't have that many opportunities to provide new housing, and we shouldn't be unnecessarily scaling back units that are built in appropriate places that have those access to those amenities.
Fisk added that his group is, quote, deeply disappointed that the Design Review Committee is continuing to put you in this position by denying these projects that are clearly consistent with objective standards. Commissioner Steve Lazar said the project replaces a former structure that was smaller, but it's in full compliance with the city's development standards for the neighborhood.
It's helpful just for folks, just to recognize the reality from a land use planning standpoint. When I bought my house in Eureka, over 15 years ago, I looked at the neighborhood in which it was located and said, oh, wow, it's multifamily, but it's all single family homes. So, okay, I guess that means that if there were vacant lots or something were to be removed, it could be redeveloped. So I think you have to understand that from a planning standpoint, this is the plan. And it's been the plan not for just a couple of years, but for quite a few years, I believe. And it's one thing to be planned for that, but the reality is most of this is built out. And a lot of it's built out with single family homes. But some of those homes were large enough that they've been converted to multifamily residences. I think we all have seen that. So in this case, there was a two-story or one-and-a-half-story Greek Revival house that burned down quite a few years ago. And now we're looking at a development that's quite a bit denser than what was there previously. But it's absolutely consistent with the plan for this area.
Commissioner Michael Kraft said he has deeply mixed feelings but doesn't see what he called a good legal foundation for doing anything other than reversing the Design Review Committee's denial. With two members absent, the commission unanimously voted to reverse the denial and approve the project. The commission's decision can be challenged with an appeal to the city council. In Eureka for KMUD News, this is Daniel Mintz.
In state news, California leaders warn of severe fallout from federal workforce and program cuts, KPFA's Vic Bedoin reports.
The federal government's decision to slash the federal workforce, eliminate research programs, and abandon stewardship of public lands is expected to have severe consequences for California. State leaders have raised concerns about the growing impact on critical sectors including wildfire response, water management, coastal and ocean preservation, public recreation, and clean energy development. Sarah Amanzadeh, Deputy Secretary of the California Natural Resources Agency, has been closely monitoring the unfolding budget decisions in Washington, D.C., and their complex and far-reaching implications for the state.
If you're having trouble sorting through articles and what's online with what's actually happening, you're not alone. I would say that there's an intentional effort to make it a bit confusing. But over the next month is when Congress and Senate will be marking up these bills and making a decision. So this is the critical time to make your voices heard. And we're hoping that you can learn more about what's being contemplated, what California is doing, and really step up to make your voices heard.
Fire-prone communities throughout the state are bracing for the impacts that the budget cuts and forced reductions will have as the vegetation dries through the long summer. Patrick Wright is director of the governor's Wildfire and Forest Resilience Task Force. He said federal partnership is crucial to the state's firefighting efforts. Wright added that the National Guard's firefighting crews are at only 40% of capacity due to Trump's deployment of troops to Los Angeles.
Across the board, we're hearing there have been more than a 10% cut in Forest Service staff, both in the region and nationally, including a 25% cut in folks that are non-firefighters. 10% may not sound like a lot, but the big concern on the wildfire side is not the actual firefighters, but it's the support services. It's the folks that do logistics, transportation, meals. Very serious concern on the part of CAL FIRE and other non-federal partners that we simply aren't going to have the capacity we need going in to this year's fire season.
California's water system will also be impacted. The state and feds work closely together on water delivery operations. Department of Water Resources Chief Carla Nemeth said deep cuts to the Bureau of Reclamation could impact farmers and wildlife. Other cuts include drought relief, flood protection, and salmon recovery programs. Likewise, Jen Eckerly of the state's Ocean Protection Council warned of the damage that could be done to coastal and ocean resources by undoing oceanic and climate studies. Eckerly listed numerous critical research outposts that protect health and safety that the federal government wants to shut down. She pointed out that, meanwhile, offshore oil and gas development is slated to increase.
Since January of this year, the actions from the Trump administration have significantly reduced the federal workforce and funding and science programs. And this is impacting coastal and ocean research and monitoring management programs across California. It includes funding and staffing cuts that are threatening our nation's key ocean agency, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA. And NOAA provides vital information and services, including weather forecasting, climate monitoring, and management of fisheries and our other coastal and ocean resources across the country.
Nearly half of California's landscape is owned and operated by the federal government. Drastic reductions to staff at national parks, national forests, and wildlife refuges have already happened, with more cuts expected. With recreation such a big part of the state's economy, the impacts are already being felt, especially in small rural gateway towns. Dana Stroud with the Governor's Office of Business says those communities rely heavily on visitors to nearby national parks and landmarks, and any drop in tourism hits them hard.
What we're starting to see very specifically are the responsibilities that are falling on our local communities to cover the loss of staff and the loss of services that were previously being provided by our federal partners. So we're going to start to see and have already been experiencing a change in how trash is picked up and managed, and the maintenance of the restrooms that our visitors use. We're also starting to see where federal staff is not available to process projects where we want to have trail improvements or where we want to have a change in their access.
Energy consumers will face rising costs as well, with solar tax credits going away in 2 years. In closing, Resources Secretary Wade Crowfoot advised Californians to stay informed, make your voices heard, and build bridges with others, offering a few words of encouragement.
None of us are powerless in this situation. We are stronger together, and knowledge is power.
Kofoed noted that an effort in Congress to sell off public lands was withdrawn after bipartisan opposition. Vic Bedoyan reporting for the Pacifica Evening News and KFCF Radio.
In National Native News, Antonia Gonzalez reads today's headlines.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Fallon Paiute Shoshone tribe is expanding healthcare access with a mobile clinic in Nevada. The Mountain West News Bureau's Kayla Bradle has more on how it's getting tribal patients the healthcare they need.
After years of driving their vehicles to neighboring reservations, the tribe bought a mobile clinic last year. It was funded by a $673,000 grant from the U.S. Department of Agriculture, aimed at expanding rural healthcare access after the pandemic. The tribe's mobile clinic serves its members and drives to the Lovelock Paiute and Yamba Shoshone reservations, covering a territory of about 200 miles. It can also treat any member of a tribe in Nevada. John Pishon is the director of the Fallon Tribal Health Center. Pishon says they serve about 2,000 people, averaging about 20 patients each month. They try to visit each tribe at least once a month, but that isn't always easy.
Challenges is weather and distance. They are far away, and during winter, sometimes these areas get a little hard to access.
Mobile health clinics are also being used by the Navajo Nation, the White Mountain Apache tribe in Arizona, and the Fort Peck tribes in Montana.
I think having the providers go into the community open their eyes to the needs and how to better serve them.
Dr. Christopher Chai is working at the mobile clinic here in Lovelock. He says they can even act as an urgent care for injuries and wounds.
We will get the random rancher come in with a broken finger and say, like, what do I do with this? Sliced open, and we can put in stitches.
Pishon adds that the clinic also helps tribal members be proactive instead of reactive about their health.
We have some people that maybe only come in when they're sick, but now they're seeing us for their preventative care when we come out.
Like Barbara Bonta, an elder of the Walker River Paiute tribe who lives in Lovelock.
I've been seeing them for my feet and other problems that I didn't know I had until they start testing this and that.
Bonta was brought to the mobile clinic by her daughter, Tia Happy.
With my mom, she can't sit for a long time, you know, in a car to go to Fallon or elsewhere to appointments, so it makes it super convenient to have it here when the mobile comes here.
Happy says her mom's been seeing Dr. Chai for the past 2 years. Consistent care that's been made possible by this mobile clinic, which isn't slowing down. This year, the clinic plans to add dental care to its services. For National Native News, I'm Caleb Radel.
Arizona Governor Katie Hobbs announced last week the launch of the Turquoise Alert System for Missing Native Americans. It's a new tool intended to help the state's Department of Public Safety and law enforcement respond when vulnerable people go missing. In May, Hobbs signed legislation creating the alert. It was deployed before its effective date this fall. Hobbs says the tool is a meaningful step to improve the safety and well-being of communities across Arizona, and in particular, tribal communities, which have suffered from a crisis of missing and murdered Indigenous people. Tribal leaders were among those to advocate for the alert system. Gila River Indian Community Governor Stephen Ralewis took to social media to announce the launch of the Turquoise Alert, saying it's in honor of Emily Pike, a San Carlos Apache teenager who went missing and was later found dead.
I feel the weight of every story of a missing loved one. Now, the creation of the Turquoise Alert System through Emily's Law is deeply meaningful to me and to all tribal communities across Arizona. We have long lived with the painful reality that our Indigenous brothers and sisters, our relatives, go missing at alarming rates and too often slip through the cracks of systems not built to protect them.
Governor Lewis says the Turquoise Alert gives tribal communities a fighting chance to bring their relatives home. The alert will be activated when a person goes missing under unexplained or suspicious circumstances and is believed to be endangered. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Network.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thanks for listening. Thanks to our engineer, Javier Rodriguez, and thanks to our reporters, Daniel Mintz, Vic Pedoin, and Antonia Gonzalez. KMUD News is online, and you can find us on KMUD.org. and now streaming on most podcast platforms, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify, where you can download our stories and newscasts for offline listening during your rural commutes, and you can follow us on social media. If you have questions or suggestions, you can give us a call at 707-923-2605 or send an email to news@kmud.org. Redwood Community Radio is funded by Press Forward, the national movement to strengthen communities by reinvigorating local news. Learn more at pressforward.news. Reporting for KMUD, I'm Jordan Pangelinan.